From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the Japanese surrender in World War II. Eric Lomax is a British veteran who was a POW held by the Japanese during the war. He never quite recovered from the interrogations and torture. Recently, he found the man who interrogated him. On today's Fresh Air, Eric Lomax tells us why he forgave his interrogator. It's been more than 60 years since the Hackberry Ramblers started playing Cajun music. We'll meet one of the founding members. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Bonfire of the Humanities, Television, Subliteracy, and Long-Term Memory Loss by David Mark, a man who loves books and television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saturday was the 50th anniversary of the Japanese surrender in World War II. My guest Eric Lomax has an extraordinary story of how he reconciled with the man who was his worst enemy during the war. Lomax is a British veteran who was taken prisoner of war by the Japanese in 1942. He and several of his fellow POWs scavenged materials to build a makeshift radio receiver, which they used to monitor news of the war. The guards discovered the receiver, and the men who built it were punished with brutal beatings. Two men were beaten to death. Lomax survived, though most of his limbs were broken. Before he had time to heal, his Japanese captors, believing Lomax was a spy, interrogated and tortured him. The sound of the interrogator's voice haunted Lomax decades after the war ended, but a couple of years ago he met his tormentor and finally forgave him. Lomax explains in his new memoir, The Railway Man. I asked him what he remembers about the men who presided over his torture.
There were always two men. One was an NCO, a sergeant of the Kempeitai, that is the Japanese military police, and he changed from time to time. I think the Japanese sent for reinforcements when they found they weren't getting results. The second man, a small man, who was there the whole time, possibly for as long a period as 10 days. And he was an interpreter, basically a civilian rather than a soldier, but nevertheless under military discipline. And his job was to carry out the interrogation. He was, of course, an interpreter. He was the only person in that particular group of Japanese who could speak English. So he had to continue soldiering on for a period of somewhere about a week. There was no replacement for him, no reinforcements. So I saw a great deal of him for a period of a week or 10 days.
This is the man who you've since met and forgiven. Tell me a little bit about what he became in your mind, what he started to symbolize to you.
Well, every POW saw hundreds, if not thousands, of Japanese troops at one time or another. And generally speaking, we never saw any one for any particular length of time, with the exception of my interpreter, whom I was very close to indeed for a whole week. So over a period of time, and certainly after the war, the entire Japanese army was practically focused to me through this one particular face, this one particular voice. And, of course, I didn't know his name. I could only visualize him from his appearance and from his voice. It was unusual for any POW to become so close, in the worst sense of the term, with any particular Japanese.
What kind of questions would he ask you, and what kind of threats did he make?
Well, the questions were very wide-ranging, very varied, but they were really aimed at trying to establish that the POWs in my little group were in contact with the Siamese civilians and that we were trying to organise some sort of sabotage or uprising or general insurrection. We, of course, were not, in fact, in contact with them, but this was a very difficult matter to establish. the Japanese wanted to identify a spy, and they tried very hard indeed to establish that it was myself.
So what were the threats that he would give you?
Well, by that time we had all had some very severe beatings. My arms were in splints throughout the whole of the interviews from end to end, and the threats were really directed towards further beatings. And then eventually I was informed that I was going to be killed in any case, so perhaps it would make it easier for myself if I started to talk. In fact, that didn't make any difference in the long run, because if any group of interrogators have a victim with information which they want, the last thing they're going to do is to kill him, because they would lose their source of information.
So in between his interrogation and his threats, you were tortured, you were beaten. There was a water torture also, in which they basically poured water down your nose and down your throat, and you came very close to drowning, and then they'd revive you, bring you back to life for more interrogation and more torture.
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly as it happened. Much of my information about this, strangely enough, comes from a little book written by the interpreter himself, because I think I must have been semi-conscious for part of the time and totally unconscious for part of the time, because the interpreter, whose name I didn't know at that time, has described the whole event in terms which I can't altogether recognize.
Did you ever try to reach him as a fellow human being and you know, just beg him to stop?
I don't think so. I think the nearest I got to that was a little bit of a sidetracking attempt when I decided to ask him about the Japanese educational system. This was intended to waste time and generally deflect their concentration on myself. And he rose to the occasion and started to tell me about the Japanese educational system. And we had quite a bit of a conversation about this, but I could see on his right-hand side the military police NCO getting very restless and restive, and eventually he started to lay into the interpreter, obviously asking what we were doing, what we were talking about, and so on. And then he told the interpreter that he was supposed to be asking the questions, not me.
Was there ever a moment during the interrogations when you felt that your interrogator was trying to talk to you like a human being?
Very occasionally, yes, but not until we eventually parted company. On the very last day, when my colleagues and I were being put into a Japanese army truck, and of course we had no idea where we were going, I was the last to get on the truck because I had to be assisted. And the interpreter turned to me and said, "Keep your chin up."
Now, I'm going to jump ahead several decades to the late 1980s, when you found out who your anonymous interpreter interrogator was. How did you find out his identity?
I tried for about 5 years by making inquiries, and then eventually one day, when I was in the middle of my inquiries, I was given a photocopy of a cutting from the Japan Times, dated the 15th of August, 1989. And the cutting showed the photograph of a Japanese with quite a lot of accompanying text, and of course it was in English. I recognised the photograph, and I began to read the text, and within a matter of minutes I'd come to the conclusion that this was a modern photograph of the young man who had been my interrogator. And the text was exceptionally interesting. It gave his name. It quoted his name as Nagase Takashi. I had not heard that name up to that point. And it also explained how the man concerned had suffered terribly, physically and psychologically, during the 40-odd years since the end of the war, how he had been terribly upset by the being involved in the ill-treatment and torture of a British Royal Signals officer. And the whole thing quite obviously referred to myself. I just couldn't believe this coincidence. It took quite a little while before it really sunk in that after several years' work, I'd finally identified the man that I was pursuing.
Why were you pursuing him? Why did you want to find him in the first place?
Very hard to explain. Just something that drove me on. I didn't do much about it for the first 40 years after the end of the war. I was busy, like everybody else, earning a living. But when I retired early in the 1980s, I began to pursue him. I had ideas about doing him some harm, and this idea persisted for quite a long time. But eventually, I began to moderate that idea and toned it all down. But it's very hard to explain why I wanted to pursue him, just something that drove me on to try to identify the man who had been such a central feature of my life and ill-treatment as a POW.
But your initial motivation was revenge.
Yes. Yes, absolutely right.
So when you read this article from a Japanese paper that said that he was remorseful, did you buy this? Did you believe it?
I took it at face value, but I decided to make a lot of further inquiries. And in fact, I spent well over a year making further inquiries. I got press cuttings, I got magazine articles about the man, I wrote to the British Embassy in Tokyo for further information. Everybody told me the same story, that he appeared to be apologetic, that he seemed to be trying to put things right, that he was opposing Japanese militarism, and that in general terms he was trying to get on with various charitable and other good works, partly in Japan and partly in Thailand.
And what made you decide to actually try to contact him and meet him?
Well, it seemed to be the logical next step, that all the inquiries I made brought satisfactory results. So my wife, Patty, decided to write to him with my full support. So she sent off a letter, and I think the letter must have given Mr. Nagase the most terrible fright, because we discovered afterwards that he had thought I had been dead for many, many years, and to get a letter from the dead must give anyone a little bit of a fright. However, he responded very quickly indeed and wrote the most beautiful letter, full of apologies, full of expressions of remorse, and then we continued the correspondence, and the correspondence continued, not exactly overnight, but with gaps, for a period of well over a year. And we discussed the possibility of having a meeting. And I could see no reason for not having a meeting, so we pressed on, and we eventually met, as is quoted in the book, we eventually met early in 1993 in Thailand.
My guest is Eric Lomax. His new memoir is called The Railway Man. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Eric Lomax, his new memoir, The Railway Man, is about the years he was held prisoner of war by the Japanese. He recently met and forgave his interrogator. I'd like to hear your description of the moment that you met the interpreter who interrogated you.
Well, it was certainly quite remarkable. There has never been another occasion like it in my life, as one can well imagine. We arranged to meet at 10 o'clock on a certain spot, a terrace, not very far from the end of the River Kwai Bridge at Kanchanaburi. I got there first. I saw this small figure approaching, and I recognised him. I'd forgotten just how small he was. I addressed him in Japanese. I just said, "Good morning, how are you?" And he replied in English, expressing his sorrow for what had happened. We shook hands and we went to sit on a nearby seat in the shade, and we talked for perhaps 45 minutes or even an hour, and we talked almost as if we were old friends meeting for the first time after many years' interval. It was really quite remarkable. There was no animosity, no aggression, no difficulty. We even talked about his army pension, and we arranged later on that day to go on a tour around Kanchanaburi to visit some of the important, some of the places which were important during the war.
Did he tell you what it was like to be in his shoes with the assignment of interrogating you?
Yes, he explained how unhappy he had been, how he was compelled to follow his orders, what a terrible situation he and his family would have been in if he had disobeyed. And he even told me at one point that he was reprimanded by his superiors in the military police for not being fierce enough with me.
Over 45 years had elapsed between the time that he interrogated you and the time that you met him again. Were there questions you had stored up over the years? You know, if I ever get to meet him, this is what I would ask.
Yes, you're quite right. There were quite a number of things that I had stored up, and I never really got answers to them, I think quite genuinely, because Mr. Ningassi was not in a position to answer them. I wanted to know who had given the orders for the search which led to the discovery of the radios. I wanted to know why they suspected we had a radio at all. And I wanted to know about the fate of the military police NCOs who had interrogated me sitting beside Mr. Ningassi. And I couldn't get answers to any of these questions. I think Mr. Ningassi quite genuinely didn't know. But one curious side issue came to the surface, and that was that the Japanese regarded me as a bit of a prize catch. And they brought Mr. Ningassi specially from Saigon in Indochina to Kanchanaburi in Thailand in order to interrogate me, because they didn't think they had anybody available locally who was a sufficiently good interpreter. And another thing I discovered was that I was apparently the only POW questioned by Mr. Ningassi. He was transferred to other duties immediately after he had finished with me. This was quite important because it meant that for the rest of his life, the ill effects of that ill-treatment and that torture could be attributable to his confrontation with myself.
Right, when he thought about the torture, you were the victim. You
yes.
You were the only victim that he
yes.
was responsible for. So you were as important in his mind as he was in yours, in a way.
Absolutely, yes, this is perfectly true.
Now, why did the Japanese think of you as such a prize catch?
Well, I was a lieutenant in the Royal Signals. We were very highly trained in communication, in radio and other forms of communication. The Japanese were rather backward at that particular time. We were well ahead of them technically. And I think they attributed a little bit too much to a Royal Signals officer. They seemed to think that we could make transmitters out of banana skins and this sort of thing, which of course we could not do. So they thought that I would almost certainly have organized any difficulty or general communication matters for miles around. In actual fact, they attributed a little bit too much to me.
Did you get a sense of what transformed him?
Yes, he explained how he was a devout Buddhist and he required forgiveness, not only for purposes of this life, but for purposes of the future life. He explained how he had understood that I had died many, many years before, and that this upset his long-term prospects and certainly his prospects in the future world. So he was particularly glad that I had survived, particularly glad that we were having meetings and having conversations, and quite obviously he wanted my forgiveness. And there now developed a little bit of a cultural problem, because he understood that my appearance at Kanchanaburi and our meeting and our discussion constituted forgiveness. And he told me that this was the happiest day of his life. These were his exact words. In fact, I had not forgiven him at that point, and I hadn't given him any indication that I had. I carried forward the idea that I might forgive him, but I wanted to have further conversations, further discussions with him. After all, we'd planned to spend somewhere about a further 3 weeks together, and I certainly had not forgiven him at that first point. but Mr. Nagasse thought I had forgiven him, so we had to sort that out.
When did you forgive him?
About 3 weeks later, shortly before we were due to leave Tokyo, Mr. and Mrs. Nagasse and my wife and I were in next-door bedrooms in a hotel in Tokyo, and I decided at that point, after 3 weeks of further conversation and contact with Nagasse, I decided that I could in fact forgive him. So I wrote him out a carefully worded letter of forgiveness, which I thought would meet his Buddhist requirements, quite apart from his day-to-day requirements, and I arranged to have a little private meeting with him one morning in his bedroom, gave him this letter, went over it word by word to make sure that he understood every word of it, and he was absolutely delighted. And I have never had the slightest reason to doubt his honesty or his integrity or his authenticity. I think he is absolutely genuine, and I stand by that forgiveness that I gave him.
What did you say in the letter?
Well, I'd have to quote from memory. It is, in fact, in the book, but I explained that he was taking too much of the entire guilt of the Japanese nation on his own shoulders, that he was quite right to oppose militarism, that I personally was quite satisfied with his post-war life, his post-war career, that he had demonstrated his regret at what happened in 1943, that I understood he was acting under orders, and I was quite happy to give him forgiveness.
How has offering forgiveness to your interrogator changed you and changed your dreams even?
Well, I think one almost has to ask other people that, but so far as I can answer the question, it lifts a burden, it lightens one's load. And almost going off at a slight tangent, I can see no point in perpetuating hatefulness or bitterness, because it doesn't do any harm to the person that one is hating. It just pulls down the person who is being hateful and bitter. But it's very hard to generalise about this. It's so much a personal matter.
Do you communicate with Mr. Nagasse anymore?
Yes, we write and we telephone. We hope to meet again. We have no immediate plans for meeting. Well, I suppose we'll have to do it fairly quickly. He's slightly older than I am. We're both old enough. So I think we'll probably have to arrange that. But we have no immediate plans. But yes, I would like to see him again, very much indeed.
Did meeting Mr. Nagasse give you more hope about the human condition?
Yes. But only in a very, very small way.
Right, a select few.
Yes. After all, there are only two of us, as distinct from millions of millions of other people. But yes, it does suggest that it is possible for two people with goodwill to become reconciled. And I would certainly take pleasure in meeting Mr. Nagasse again.
I thank you so much for sharing some of your story with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Eric Lomax, his new memoir is called The Railway Man. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
The most popular Cajun band of the 1930s is still performing. Coming up, we meet two members of the Hackberry Ramblers. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews Bonfire of the Humanities, Television, Subliteracy, and Long-Term Memory Loss by David Marr. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most popular Cajun band of the 1930s is still playing today. Their biggest hit, recorded in 1936, was Jolie Blonde, a song that's been called the Cajun National Anthem. In the 30s and 40s, the Hackberry Ramblers recorded more than 100 songs for RCA Victor's Bluebird label. They recorded songs in French and English, but when they recorded in English, they were called the Riverside Ramblers. In 1992, the Hackberry Ramblers made their first record in 30 years. My guests are Ludren Darbone, one of the founding members of the band, and Ben Sandmel, the band's youngest member. Darbone is a fiddler born in 1913 in Evangeline, Louisiana. Sandmel is a music writer and producer who became the band's drummer in 1987. Let's start with the Hackberry Ramblers' 1936 recording of Jolie Blonde. Ludren Darbone of the Hackberry Ramblers told me how the band got started.
When we first started, of course, it was during the Depression. And there was no way that we could find a job. And after we played a few parties and then we got connected with a brand new radio station in Lake Charles, I got a spot 15 minutes on a Monday morning. And we'd drive from Hackberry, which was about 35 or 40 miles. We had a ferry to cross, so that meant having to leave pretty early. The program was for 6 o'clock in the morning. So anyway, we broadcast about 3 or 4 Mondays like that. And we got a request from some people in Bazeal, which was about 60 miles from Hackberry. And they were interested in getting us to play a dance. So, of course, that kind of got us excited, you know, not thinking that that anybody with a commercial dance hall would want us to play. We were more or less thinking about parties, you know.
Let me jump ahead, I guess about 60 years. And yes. Ben Selmel, let me ask you how you ended up becoming the youngest by far member of the Hackberry Ramblers.
Well, I was doing the programming and the booking for the state of Louisiana's Folklife Festival in 1987, and I had been trying to book the Hackberry Ramblers on a couple of events for several years before that, and I had been in touch with the wrong people. I finally got in touch with Mr. Darbone and booked the band on the festival, and they showed up without a drummer, and I was filling in with another band whose drummer had not shown up. And we got to talking, and they asked me to sit in, and we just clicked as if we'd been playing together for years. It was a very special moment.
Now, you initially contacted the Hackberries because you were interested in booking them for a festival.
Yes.
Where do you think the Hackberry Ramblers fit in the larger history of Cajun music?
The Hackberry Ramblers are known for bringing two major innovations to Cajun music. First, they were the first group to incorporate Anglo-American country music, specifically Western swing, and other related country styles which were known under the general heading of hillbilly string band music. They were the first group to incorporate that into the Cajun repertoire. And the other important innovation was the introduction of sound systems and electronic amplification into the dance halls. And they love to tell the story of how they ran the PA system off the battery of their car, which was idling outside.
Well, why don't we hear the story?
Okay.
Ludwin, how did you start to amplify?
First of all, I might say that I had a service station, and I would receive catalogs listing articles for sale.
This is what, in the 1930s we're talking?
Yeah, that was about in 32, I guess. But anyway, I get this catalog from a firm in Chicago. And they had in there a public address system. And I knew that a lot of the politicians had these public address systems so people could hear their voices. And I had, we were three in the band, a fiddle and two guitars. And one of the fellows that played guitar was also our Cajun singer. But he had a good voice, but it didn't carry too far. In other words, if you'd be staying away 30 or 40 feet, it wasn't quite loud enough to really to hear the distinct words, you know. So I got to thinking, well, maybe by getting this public address system and using it, well, when he'd sing, well, then everybody could hear him. So I decided to order it, not thinking that it would also pick up the music, you know. So I ordered it, and I got it. We played a dance at a place called Evangeline, Louisiana, and we set it up and put the loudspeaker across from us, other side of the hall, and we started playing, and good night. People were amazed at the fact that they could hear the music on the other side of the hall.
I bet a lot of the places that you played didn't even have electricity. So how did you power the PA system?
Some of the dance halls had electricity. But then some of the dance halls had electricity that was powered with a DC unit. And our amplifier had to be used with an AC current, you see, alternating current. So there was a fellow, I went to see him. I had heard that he could make a generator that would convert DC to AC current. So I talked to him. He said, yeah. He said, I'll make you a generator, and you can run off your car. So he put it on there. And we'd go to a place where there was no AC current, and we'd connect our generator on the car. I had to loosen the other generator and use the same belt, you see, and run the car. And we'd run the car during the dance, which was 4 hours, and the car would just run idle.
And did you ruin your car?
No, but it took a little gasoline. Of course, gasoline was 15 cents a gallon then, you know, it didn't matter.
Why don't we hear something that the Hackberry Ramblers recorded in the 1930s? And we'll hear Et Là-Bas. And Ludwin, you're the vocalist and fiddler on this track. What style is this?
Well, it's a sort of a hybrid style, but still there's a lot of Cajun behind it because it's sung in Cajun, you see. Now, I learned to speak French when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And when I became six, my mother told me to quit talking French and talk English because I was getting ready to start school. And naturally, if you talked broken, well, then the kids would make fun of you. So she wanted me to be able to talk strictly English. But anyway, I still remembered Cajun language. And we had a recording session coming up, and I had my Cajun singer had quit for some reason. He got a job or something, and we didn't have a Cajun singer. And they had told me they wanted 4 Cajun records. I think I wrote 6 numbers, and the others are just instrumental.
Well, this is Et Là-Bas, and my guest, Ludwin Darbon, is on vocals and fiddle. And this is the Hackberry Ramblers, recorded in the 1930s.
Foi a ver que o papai me disse, me bebe. Ao ser de fim, mal sonhei, esbatu, donde me calejou. De mamão, ao é lá bom, o pai de dia do papai de mabel, por de jo.
That's the Hackberry Ramblers, recorded in the 1930s. Lenren, you were saying that what your mother didn't want you to speak French when you were growing up. Is that what you said?
Well, later on in life, I found out that all families had their children stop talking French. They wanted them to talk English. You know, that was really, if you could talk English, it seemed like you could progress more in life.
My guests are Ledwin Darbone and Ben Sandmill of the Hackberry Ramblers. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are fiddler Ledwin Darbone, who co-founded the Hackberry Ramblers in the 1930s, and drummer Ben Sandmill, the group's youngest member. Now, the Hackberry Ramblers first recorded in the 1930s, and then there was a period, I think, where you didn't record at all.
Well, we recorded in the 40s also.
Mm-hmm.
Recorded for Deluxe Record Company.
And then in the mid-1960s, I think it was, Chris Strachwitz,
yeah,
who
mm-hmm.
owns our Hooley Records,
mm-hmm.
went looking for you.
He
found you.
He
and recorded some more sessions.
He went to Hackberry. You know, he knew Hackberry Ramblers. Figured we were still living in Hackberry, so he went over there and he asked somebody. He said, "Do you know where Darbone, one of the Hackberry Ramblers, lives?" Figured I lived in that area. The person said, "No, but I know where he lives. He lives in Sulphur." So he got to the house, so it was getting late. It was just beginning to get dark. And he knocked, he rang the doorbell. I had a doorbell at that time. The thing is worn out now, but anyway, I went to the door, and there was this man standing there, and he had an album in his hand. So he told me, he said, "I've got something here for you." So he gave me an album. And I looked at it, and he said, "You've got a couple of your records on there." So I said, "Well, great." I said, "Come in." So he came in, and that's when he asked us if we wanted to record for him.
Let's hear how the band sounded in the 1960s. Contrast that with the 1930s. Why don't we hear something that shows off your fiddle playing? And this is Black Bayou Rag.
Thank you.
So after this record came out, did it change your life? Had you been retired from music, or were you still performing?
Well, we when Chris came, we were in getting ready to retire. We were going to quit playing.
How old were you?
At that time?
Yeah.
Well, see, I'm 82 now. Well, that was in 63. So that's 30-some-odd years ago. I was in my 50s, I suppose. But anyway, we were all working. See, we all had day jobs. And we decided, well, we've been playing so long, we just thought, just stop playing. But then when the album came out, well, naturally, we wanted to continue playing since we had an album out on the market. And about 2 years later, we got an invitation to go to the Berklee Festival in California. So we went in 1965, and that was the first festival that we played. We played there for a solid week. They had us playing concerts 2 and 3 times a day, and also workshops. So we really did some playing there for a week in California.
Ludwin, you're 82 now, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is it hard for you to play? A lot of people of your age have arthritis and things like that that make it hard for them to lift a cup of coffee, let alone to play a fiddle.
No, I've been fortunate. So far, so good. No arthritis and nothing else except I have one eye that's giving me a little trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, and then, of course, my hearing's a little not like it used to be. But my health is top because every year I have an annual checkup.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, everything was right on the money.
Fiddler Ludwin Darbone and drummer Ben Sandmel of the Hackberry Ramblers. Their latest CD is called Cajun Boogie.
So long, everyone, it's time for us to go. The Hackberry Ramblers must play another show. We're moving on down the line, we'll see y'all next time. Oh, move it, son. Everybody had a good time, huh? Yeah, the original Hackberry Ramblers.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we're going to be hearing today, Terry, about the latest in Bosnia. Also about Hillary Rodham Clinton's speech to the UN Women's Conference in Beijing, a speech that was heard as an indirect criticism of the host country, China. And also on today's program, Ira Glass reports on reforming the public school system of Chicago. For many years, nobody could figure out, they said, how to balance the budget of the Chicago public schools. But then a small team came along and did it in a matter of weeks, and apparently without making things any rougher for classroom teachers.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In an earlier book, Comic Visions, television critic David Mark wrote about the evolution of the American sitcom. But in his latest book, Bonfire of the Humanities, Mark turns to a scarier subject, the clash between the traditional world of books and the brave new world of electronic media. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says she knows which side she's on, both.
What a mistake it was for me to pick up David Mark's Bonfire of the Humanities the very same week that fall semester classes begin. Here I am, psyching myself up to give freshmen a rousing Ms. Chip speech about how their required literature and writing seminars are the most important classes they'll ever take in college. Meanwhile, I've now got Mark's wise, droll voice ringing in my head, telling me that as an English professor, I'm pretty much the equivalent of an Alaskan scrimshaw carver, desperately trying to preserve the techniques of my dying craft. For the next 4 years, Mark predicts, my students will play along. They'll write essays and wade through Moby Dick, and in return, they'll receive a diploma, basically their union card for middle-class status. and for the remainder of their lives, reading and writing will never again be a priority. Cable TV, CD-ROMs, videos, and the Internet will claim the time earlier generations devoted to Paradise Lost or even pulp magazines. Mark knows whereof he speaks. He's a scholar who's enraged at academic ostriches who stick their heads in the sand while the electronic media encroaches onto the humanities turf. But unlike, say, William Bennett, who Mark witheringly describes as a redneck humanist, Mark is no cultural elitist. In fact, he's made his reputation as one of the most insightful television critics around today. Because Mark is this odd creature who loves both literature and TV, Bonfire of the Humanities offers a fresh, wide-ranging discussion of the crisis in the liberal arts. And it's funny, too. In his first chapter, Mark asks his readers, "Would you rather be watching TV than reading this book?" Even though one of my favorite Frasier reruns was on when I reached that page, I could honestly answer, "I don't think so." Mark assumes that his readers, like himself, have spent thousands of hours staring at the tube and consequently suffer from short attention spans. So he's divided his book into what he calls segments, brief essays you can dip into at random that give you the sensation of channel surfing. In a scant 150 pages of text, Mark discusses the idiocy of the political correctness debate, the disintegration of historical memory, and his own early love affairs with Wordsworth and Have Gun Will Travel. Mark's segment on the history of TV criticism resurrects the neglected critic Gilbert Seldes. At the same time, he acknowledges that in-depth TV criticism hasn't attracted much of an audience. In one of the most courageous acts I've ever witnessed of a writer coming clean with his readers, Mark confesses that after writing 3 books and over 100 articles about TV, he's received exactly 11 letters from readers, one of them chiding him for mischaracterizing Lieutenant Commander Quentin McHale on McHale's Navy as a non-commissioned officer. Despite such dismal fan mail, Mark's own narrative voice is the best argument for reading I can imagine. Edgy, digressive, massively learned, sometimes nasty, frequently hilarious, and occasionally poignant. It's impossible to imagine the workings of such an interesting mind without the enduring power of other well-wrought words to challenge and inspire it. In the words of a poet Mark reveres, his voice contains multitudes.
Maureen Corrigan reviewed Bonfire of the Humanities by David Mark. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of a newly discovered novel by Louisa May Alcott, A Long Fatal Love Chase. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Reuters News Service is reporting several shells have landed inside Sarajevo near the city center. It's not clear where the shells came from. They hit hours after NATO resumed airstrikes on Bosnian Serb positions after the Bosnian Serbs failed to comply with United Nations demands. Regina Sansaloni reports from Rome.
The order to bomb Serb targets reached NATO's Southern Command in Naples this morning at 11 a.m. local time, exactly 12 hours after the expiration of the ultimatum, which called for the removal of heavy artillery from the exclusion zone around Sarajevo. The first wave of airstrikes followed 2 hours later, with planes taking off from Aviano and other Italian air bases, as well as the U.S. aircraft carrier Roosevelt, stationed in the Adriatic Sea off the coast of former Yugoslavia. NATO is currently assessing the effectiveness of the attacks, and the head of the European Southern Command, Admiral Leighton Smith, will give a press conference tomorrow morning in Naples to detail the results of today's bombing. For National Public Radio, this is Regina Sansaloni in Rome.
Attendees of the United Nations Conference on Women are debating a platform. The 120-page document calls for action to get rid of poverty and improve health care, education, and job opportunities for women. The delegation from the Vatican says the platform gives short shrift to marriage and motherhood. The Vatican's delegation leader, Marianne Glendon, says women's progress should not be in exchange for lesser roles for women within the family. Other delegates complain the platform is too conservative and isn't strong enough in condemning racism and poverty. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is sending advisors and supplies to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands as Hurricane Luis begins to lash the region. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
FEMA already has communications specialists on the ground in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Today, it's sending out a C-5A transport plane filled with trucks and disaster teams. Federal officials are also packing up emergency supplies and satellite units so they can be quickly shipped to any area that needs them once the storm hits. And the governors of both U.S. territories have activated the National Guard. Forecasters at the National Weather Service say the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico will experience the full force of the hurricane's winds later today and tomorrow. Hurricane Luis is following a similar path to Hugo. That 1989 hurricane left parts of Puerto Rico without electricity and running water for up to 3 weeks. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Meanwhile, Hurricane Luis has lost a little strength, but it's still crashing across Caribbean islands. Luis is moving west-northwest about 50 miles east of St. Martin in the Lesser Antilles. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 25 points at 4,672 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up 17 points at 1,036. This is NPR. The Clinton administration has released its recommendations on improving copyright protections on the information superhighway. A White House task force was appointed 2 years ago to see how copyright law is adapting to new technologies. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
The administration's goal is to ensure authors and publishers who put their materials on the Internet receive the proper attribution or payment for their work. The task force report says otherwise some won't contribute to the information superhighway for fear their books, software, or movies will be stolen, that is, widely copied and distributed without permission. To address those concerns, the study recommends changes in copyright law. It says published materials on the Internet should be classified as copies, giving them official protection. The report says making copies worth more than $5,000 should be illegal. The head of the task force says it's okay to make a few duplicates for personal use, but he says someone who makes so many copies that it hurts the original author is going too far and should be prosecuted. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
Rhode Island Senator Claiborne Pell says he's retiring. The 76-year-old Democrat released a statement from his office today saying he won't seek a seventh term. Pell has Parkinson's disease, but he says his health was not a factor in his decision. He says that after 36 years in the Senate, this is the right time for his service to end. Pell, known as a liberal, is the seventh Democrat to announce his retirement from the Senate at the end of his term. This just in, a federal judge in Little Rock has quashed charges brought by the Whitewater Grand Jury against Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker and two other defendants. U.S. District Judge Henry Woods handed down the order after an hour and a half hearing earlier today. The ruling apparently does not affect a second set of charges lodged against Governor Tucker. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal judge has thrown out a fraud indictment against Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker. He's ruled that Whitewater prosecutor Kenneth Starr exceeded his authority in bringing the charges. Tucker had been accused of getting a federally backed loan under false pretenses and trying to avoid taxes on the sale of a business financed with the loan. The judge says the charges don't resemble the matters that prosecutor Starr is supposed to investigate. Tucker still faces a 13-count indictment in the case. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton is in Beijing with a U.S. delegation to the U.N. Conference on Women. At a related World Health Organization meeting, she called on governments worldwide to invest more in health care for women. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing.
Hillary Clinton praised the U.N. Women's Conference draft platform for action as showing insight to the needs of women and a new commitment to preserving the health of women and girls.
At long last, peoples and governments everywhere are beginning to understand that investing in the health of women and girls is as important to the prosperity of nations as investing in the development of open markets and trade.
Mrs. Clinton said the U.S. supports the draft platform, which the Vatican and some Islamic countries have criticized as being far too liberal. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
Reuters News Service is quoting reports from Sarajevo that say several shells hit an area close to the city center. The shells landed hours after NATO resumed airstrikes on Bosnian Serb positions. NATO and the UN want to force the Serbs to pull back their heavy weapons from around Sarajevo. Tonight in Baltimore, Cal Ripken is scheduled to start at shortstop for the Baltimore Orioles. When he takes the field, Ripken will match one of the supposedly unbreakable records in sports. NPR's Mark Schramm reports.
Cal Ripken's played in every Orioles game since May 30, 1982. Tonight will be consecutive game number 2,130. That ties the mark set by legendary Yankees first baseman Lou Gehrig, which is considered the measure of endurance in sports. Most players sit out occasionally with injury, illness, or fatigue, but not Ripken. He's been a model of health and consistency over the last 13 years. He cites his love of the game and desire to play as reasons for his durability.
The idea simply is to put your best team on the field each and every day. And if a manager thinks I'm one of the players to be on the team in that one particular day, then I'll play.
Cal Ripken can break the record tomorrow night in Baltimore with consecutive game number 2,131. I'm Mark Schramm in Washington.
Stocks closed higher in Wall Street today. The Dow rose 22.5 points to close at 4,670. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 2-1 in active trading. This is NPR. Closing arguments have started in the New York terrorism trial. 10 Muslim fundamentalists are accused of plotting to blow up various New York landmarks, including the United Nations. Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman is one of the defendants. Prosecutors have scheduled 2 days for their close. Defense arguments and a government rebuttal are expected to make the closing last for some 2 weeks. Defense attorneys say that the FBI made up this case. They allege that the agency is trying to appear heroic by uncovering a terrorism conspiracy weeks after the deadly World Trade Center bombing. Rhode Island's senior U.S. Senator, Claiborne Pell, says he'll retire when his sixth term ends in 1996. From member station WBUR, Martha Biebinger has more.
Claiborne Pell became a senator from the country's smallest state in 1960, the same year John F. Kennedy entered the White House. Rhode Islanders harbor a special fondness for the eccentric millionaire who drives an older American car and often jogs wearing a tweed jacket. Despite his elite background, Pell is known as one of the Senate's strongest supporters of traditional liberal causes. Rumors about Pell's retirement have been circulating for years and grew louder when the 76-year-old senator announced last spring that he has Parkinson's disease. Pell is most widely known for a low-income college grant program that bears his name. He's the seventh Democratic senator to announce he won't seek re-election next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
France has tightened its border security measures in an effort to end bomb threats. French President Jacques Chirac gave the order. It comes a day after a fifth bomb was found in the country in 6 weeks. It follows other toughened security measures at airports and train stations. Chirac says the border checks are firm measures intended to ease terrorism fears, but he's also blaming the media for overplaying the stories. He says coverage has done more to destabilize French society than the bombings themselves. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.